In the great Kalahari Desert in West Africa, there lives one of the most primitive tribes on Earth. For these people, life is a constant battle for survival in a hostile environment of great material scarcity. Each morning, these people rise and spend the entire day searching for an animal that they can capture and kill. At the end of the day, they collapse, exhausted. The next day, as a matter of necessity, they repeat the process. Sometimes they fail to find the food that they require. All the available time of each day is spent in hunting, which leaves no spare time, no time for leisure at all. As a result, these people have no written language and no art, except of the most primitive kind. They have no musical instruments. They have little culture that we would call culture. They are pre-Stone Age people. The only tools they have developed of the most rudimentary kind. The 20th century West is vastly removed from that African tribal situation. With the mechanical application of solar energy, magnified with various advanced technological innovations, we can not only feed, clothe and house ourselves, but we also enjoy material advantages that are inconceivable to the Kalahari tribesmen. In addition, we also enjoy a certain amount of spare time after we have catered for the material necessities of life. We shall assess the mechanical advantages we have by comparing them with the life of the Kalahari. If the statistics are correct, one man is capable of generating 1/22 of a horsepower. A relatively modest family car can develop 100 horsepower. This means that the equivalent of 2,200 human slaves is available for personal transport in just one car. If a home is air-conditioned by a 3-horsepower motor, there are another 66 slave equivalents for blowing cool breezes. If the family is a farming family with only one tractor of 200 horsepower, then the equivalent of 4,400 farm labourers is available when required. We have hardly begun to look at the mechanical support available for building, for food, clothing, mechanical transport needs and so on, yet the message is clear. Perhaps you might like to estimate your own slave stable someday. From this point of view, the contrast between life in the industrialized West and the Kalahari Desert is staggering. In times past, small groups of people have had similar advantages. Roman patricians, the English upper classes, and other upper class groups have enjoyed sufficient wealth to employ household staff. They, therefore, had a great deal of time for leisure. In the light of these things, we will consider the concepts of work and leisure. In modern economies, human work can be defined as compulsory activity undertaken in order to obtain a financial income with which to provide for the physical necessities of life. Work is not necessarily physical effort. Sometimes public servants are characterized as attending an office 5 days a week to put in an appearance. Their activities are often seen as of doubtful significance. Many workers wonder about the value of their efforts, or perhaps their idleness. Their minds wander off to the house they're building, the concrete they could be pouring, or the holidays they're planning. Idleness at the office is not seen as leisure, and the building of a retaining wall at home is not seen as work. The reason is that one is compulsory and the other is voluntary. In his defence, the office worker, whose mind wanders off to the house he is building, is demonstrating that his mind and spirit are not enslaved to the system that demands his bodily presence for 40 hours a week. We suggest that the problem lies in the assumptions behind the present economic system. Two objectives of this present economic system are full employment and economic growth. We are told that full employment is desirable and that economic growth is a means to that end. Hence, we have thousands of workers putting in time when there is nothing to do, so that they can justify their income. We take issue with some of the assumptions behind these economic objectives. We need to ask what we really require from the productive system. What is its purpose? The logical requirement is to produce goods and services efficiently. These should be of a high quality and durability, and should be supplied in the place and at the time that suits the consumer. There is no technical reason why this cannot be done. One only has to look at our achievements on land, under the sea, and in both inner and outer space. From a technical point of view, we have a tremendously efficient production system. We have great mountains of goods that we cannot consume. Lakes of wine and lakes of milk in Europe, mountains of grain in the USA, cotton and wool in Australia and the United States, and surpluses of butter, cheese and lamb in Europe and New Zealand. We also expect the production process to provide income so that we can consume the goods produced. Now I want to make this important observation. Our production system cannot achieve both of these objectives. That is to say, our production system cannot supply full employment and sufficient income to consume the goods produced at the same time. The reason is that we have injected such efficient elements as technological change, mechanical advantage, and electrical energy into the production system. At one time, the production system could provide full employment and therefore a distribution of income so that the goods and services produced were readily consumed. With the introduction of technology, this is no longer the case. Human labour is no longer as necessary in the production process. There are a number of factories in Korea, Japan and Taiwan and the United States where human labour is not required except in a supervisory capacity. In the United States and Japan, there are robots which produce other robots for assembly line work in factories run by computers. Photoelectric cells are employed, which are thousands of times faster than the human eye and which are never deceived. These machines are not subject to fatigue, boredom, errors of judgment, or sickness. They suffer no stress, they don't go on strike, and they don't take annual leave. When a machine breaks down, it is programmed to remove itself from the assembly line and to move to a repair station where yet another robot does the repairs. In the meantime, it will be replaced by another machine. The Americans and Japanese are currently involved in a race to create a computer that will think for itself. What happens then to human labour and full employment in this technology-based production system? In this environment where production efficiency is high and where human labour is far less needed, the two objectives of full employment and economic growth actually militate against each other. Industry has resorted to consumption drives, which is the ultimate purpose of the advertising industry. Many false answers have been devised to solve the problem. The first is that industry has turned to the deliberate sabotage of goods and services. This is known as planned obsolescence. A product's useful life becomes shorter and shorter so that turnover increases and growth continues, thus maintaining the possibility of full employment. In 1960, a book called The Waste Makers by Lance Packard was published. In it, we find the following quote. Man, throughout recorded history, has struggled, often against appalling odds, to cope with material scarcity. Today, there has been a massive breakthrough. The great challenge in the US, and soon in Western Europe, is to cope with a threatened overabundance of the frills of life. The people of the United States are, in a sense, becoming a nation on a tiger. They must learn to consume more and more, or they are warned their magnificent economic machine may turn and devour them. They must be induced to step up their individual consumption higher and higher, whether they have any pressing needs for the goods or not. Their ever-expanding economy demands it. The US is already finding that the challenge of coping with its fabulous productivity is becoming a major national problem and is inspiring some ingenuous purposes and some disquieting changes. This book will deal with the systematic efforts being made to encourage citizens to be more careless and extravagant with their nation's resources and what these efforts imply. Prodigality is a spirit of the era. Historians, I suspect, may allude to this as the throwaway age. It was in 1932 that the British author Aldous Huxley wrote his book Brave New World. In the utopia that Huxley envisaged, babies came in test tubes. The citizens moved around in a zombie-like, doped-up state. To keep the industrial machinery humming, each citizen was compelled to consume a certain amount each year. The love of newness was stressed. It was necessary to adapt to the future demand and to use up the goods supplied by industry. Packard's book is a disturbing echo of Huxley's Brave New World. He quotes the marketing consultant Victor Lebeau from the Journal of Retailers. Our enormously productive economy demands that we make consumption our way of life, that we convert the buying and use of goods into rituals, that we seek our spiritual satisfactions, our ego satisfactions, in consumption. We need things to be consumed, burned up, worn out, replaced and discarded in an ever-increasing rate. At other points, Lebeau spoke of the obligation of retailers to push more goods across their counters. To consume the enormous production in the United States in the mid-50s, what was needed was strategies that would turn Americans into voracious, wasteful, compulsive consumers. These strategies should also provide products that assured such wastefulness. Even when wastefulness was not involved, additional strategies were needed that would induce the public to consume at higher levels. Packard suggested 9 such strategies and how they were implemented in the United States to build the ultimate in the throwaway society. Steaks and other meats have appeared in throwaway aluminium frying pans. Muffins come in throwaway baking tins. Hungarian goulash was offered in throwaway plastic bags. There was a throwaway mousetrap inside an aluminium shield. Once the mouse was trapped in his aluminium tomb, he just threw away the whole unit. Developments in packaging and colour coding were designed to cause people to consume more and more. For example, potato peeling knives, instead of being produced in green, red or white colours, were produced in a brown colour, so that the knife would automatically be thrown away with the potato peelings. Consumerism had gripped the United States, and I remind you that this book was written as far back as 1960. So we can see that the attempt to combine full employment with advanced technology in the production process is synonymous with a frightening waste of resources. In 1958, the United States, which had 6% of the world's population at that time, consumed over 50% of resources exploited worldwide. The environmental damage itself is frightening. Whilst the debate about the greenhouse effect is perhaps exaggerated for other purposes, and holes in the ozone layer are a natural phenomena, the environmentalists are right when they charge that our resources are being grossly abused. This mindless rape of the earth and its resources is not helping our environment. This criminal waste is happening in the name of full employment and economic growth, which has produced the cult of consumerism. If there were no answers to this disastrous process, our descendants would be condemned to a life of scarcity and want, and to life in a gigantic rubbish dump. But there are answers. The first is to remove the cause of the cult of consumerism, which is the myth of full employment. We need to return to the correct objectives of the production system, which are the efficient provision of high quality, desirable goods, where and when and as required. Whilst we improve technology and efficiency, we can and should extend the durability of things we produce. It is not technically difficult. Henry Ford demonstrated this with his Model T, which was built to last a man his lifetime. Full employment is not essential for the efficient operation of the production system, and let's therefore progress towards relieving human beings of the necessity for manual labour. We should be moving towards a new golden age of leisure, in which the machines do the work, whilst people develop their spiritual and cultural resources. But what is leisure? A person of leisure could be defined as one who possesses enough economic independence which would enable him to choose how he would express and develop his creative ability. A man of leisure does not have his activities forced on him. You could therefore define leisure as free or voluntary activity. This kind of activity is in contrast with forced activity, which we call work or labour. Physically, there may not be very much difference between a man who expends energy playing football and another who expends energy digging ditches. However, there is a tremendous psychological difference. Compare the explosive energy of the football field with the perhaps reluctant lethargy of some ditch diggers. Of course, there are some people who just love to dig ditches. Nevertheless, when the reluctant ditch digger knocks off work and goes to football training, his performance lifts dramatically. This is because he enjoys expending his energy in football. But a man digging ditches may be there only under the compulsion of obtaining a financial income. In the minds of some, leisure means having absolutely nothing to do. In ancient Greece, the natural state was a state of leisure rather than a state of work or necessary labour. In fact, the Greeks were so accustomed to leisure that they did not have a word for work. Their word for leisure was otium. Naturally enough, from time to time, the Greeks needed to be involved in overseeing the production process, which was done by slaves. They were then involved in the opposite of leisure, or the opposite of otium. They called it negotium, which led to our word, negotiation. We should treat electrical energy in the same way that the Greeks treated manpower or slave labour. We have the potential to lift the burdens from our backs and to be free to pursue genuine leisure activities. If we were free to develop our talents, cultural pursuits and abilities, we could well see a cultural explosion that we cannot even dimly envisage at the present time. For example, how many Michelangelos are currently digging ditches? How many Nellie Melbers are washing dishes? How many Beethovens and Da Vincis are cooking pizzas for a living? How much genius is being suppressed and brutalised by the artificial necessity to work for daily bread that is already being produced more efficiently by machines? The mind that is kept busy with mundane necessities is unlikely to produce truly creative ideas. This is evident from the biographies of a number of the great scientists. It was also recognised by the ancient Greeks. Aristotle once remarked that the mathematical sciences probably originated in Egypt, because there the priestly classes were allowed leisure. These priests had most of their manual work done by slaves. The great thinkers of Greek culture flourished in the period from 500 BC to 200 BC. This short period produced the science of Archimedes, the medicine of Hippocrates, the philosophy of Socrates, the academia of Plato, the poetry of Homer, the mathematics of Pythagoras, the science and philosophy of Aristotle, and much more. The reason for this was that these men had time to develop cultural pursuits. The person with talent was free, given the material support required to develop that talent. The removal of the myth of full employment would help to lead us to our own golden age. The Romans built on this Greek heritage. They contributed brilliant insights into government, law, and the organisation of human affairs. In the 12th and 13th centuries, the British devised a revolutionary new legal system, largely based on Christianity, which led to increasing social and economic stability throughout the realm. Such was their success that Thorold Rogers writes, "An Englishman could support himself and his family in comfort by working for just 15 weeks in the year." At that point in our history, there were 150 holidays, originally called holy days, in each year. There was a great deal of leisure, which led to advances in every field of human endeavour. It came to be known as Merry England. The mighty cathedrals of England were built by volunteers during their leisure time. The leisure and political stability experienced in Britain was the setting in which the writings of Shakespeare, the inductive science of Francis Bacon, and the architecture of Christopher Wren was produced. This age also produced great theologians and statesmen, artists and musicians, explorers and doctors, mathematicians, philosophers, and historians.